Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is your new Comics Wednesday episode for October 14th, 2020. I am joined by my co-host, Manny, who I just...
Hello.
Usually I say my name and pause for him to, for him to jump in, but I forgot. So sorry about that. We're all worked up from talking baseball.
Yes.
And what's going on in that world. And we didn't mention this. I know you mentioned early in the season that your fantasy football was pretty much over already. mine is not. I was feeling pretty good about my team, but then with things that happened like Cam Newton, COVID, and these games getting canceled and then not canceled. Like, I had the Kansas City defense, and then supposedly their game got canceled, so I dropped them and picked up another defense. Mm-hmm. And then their game got uncanceled, but I couldn't go back and pick that defense back up because somebody else had picked them up. And then now I don't have the Kansas City defense.
Kansas City defense is not something you want on your team anyway.
They played pretty well 2 weeks in a row, better than the – you got to realize I'm in a 16-team league, so.
Oh, okay. Jesus Christ! You have like what, one good player?
I have a few. I have a few good players, but I also have Nick Chubb who got hurt.
Oh.
And so yeah. Anyway, it's been a thing.
So I'm proud to announce that I have since Crying Wolf, I've won three games in a row. Somebody made the mistake of, for whatever reason, dropping the Ravens defense, which I picked up after my second loss in a row, which meant I was on top of the waiver wire. And also somebody was desperate enough for wide receivers that they traded me for Chris Carson, so I was able to replace my running back. And then also under the radar Crowder for the Jets.
Yeah, he's been okay.
Yeah, 25 points, 20 points, 20 points.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's but my biggest disappointment has to be the fact that I was counting on Drew Brees to being the Drew Brees, not the old man Drew Brees that we're seeing.
Stay away from him. I have Lamar Jackson as well, but right when Cam Newton went down the last two games, well, 2 weeks ago when Lamar played Kansas City, he had an awful game. And then they won. They played pretty well, but he didn't put up big numbers this last week. So I did eke out the victory this week, barely.
So I'm over 500.
I'm 3-2. I started 2-0, and I looked real strong. And then I lost two in a row. And yeah, and now I'm 3-2. So we'll see. But it's been crazy, man. These COVID tests and
dude, yes, they screw with your lineup so bad.
It almost makes it the season even more luck. Where there's more luck.
Yeah,
guys get COVID during the play. Like, imagine if it's during the playoffs and that team doesn't play that week. You could be screwed. So
yeah.
Anyway,
welcome to the Comic Source Fantasy Football Podcast.
For you guys, you're like, we want to hear about today's books. Stop talking about sports. But it's been nice, dude, to have sports on and be able to get my mind off, you know, the craziness in the world. Tonight, I had a play. I have three monitors in my setup, and I had a comic book. Still, comics are still number one. I had a comic book live auction on my main big monitor. And then on either side monitor, I had each of the playoff baseball games. And then on my iPad, my big iPad in front, I had the football game. So those were all
a picture
at the same time. And yeah, it's nice to be able to just veg out. And luckily my phone didn't ring too many times during all that. So, but what I didn't do was read any comics tonight, because I actually had read this week's comics before, although usually I get my Marvel books sometime on Tuesday and I end up reading those Tuesday evening. I did not get the Marvel books this week, unfortunately. So I'm not going to be able to talk about the latest issue of Immortal Hulk or The Amazing Spider-Man 50, which I hear is really good as well. So there's plenty of DC books to talk about, and there's a couple independents as well. So I think Manny and I are both going to talk a little bit about the latest issue of Death Metal. It's Death Metal issue 4, written by Scott Snyder. We've got art by Greg Capullo, handling the pencils, inks by Jonathan Glapion, colors by FCO Placencia, letters by Tom Napolitano, and of course, 1,000 different variant covers. which the regular cover, yeah, I was kind of like, whatever. But then when it came time to choose which of the variants I wanted, because the regular one, it's kind of cool by Capullo. It's this new version of the Batman Who Laughs, the metal version where he's like this crazy shadow, which I've never really cared for the Batman Who Laughs design. Like, I just, the band around his head with the spikes, I just don't like that. Like, how can the guy see? It just doesn't make sense to me. I don't like it. So that being said, this new one is, it's pretty simple because he's like this shadow and there's like no detail, whatever. He's just black with the eyes and almost like the Venom teeth, whatever. So it's an improvement, but it's still not a design where I'm like, oh, you know, that's the greatest character ever. And I love the Batman Who Laughs. So it's interesting, you know, that being said, I still wouldn't mind having a few more copies of his first appearance because obviously people love him and he's going to be around for a while. And I doubt that the value of that Teen Titans book will ever go down. But the other covers, the one besides the main one where it's the Batman Who Laughs shadow looking version licking the button, there's a really cool Alex Garner Superboy Prime, who I'm a big fan of Superboy Prime. So there's that cover. And then there's also a David Finch cover that's got the dark multiverse version of Darkseid on it. That's really cool. Also, he has like these tusks coming out. So I was having a hard time deciding which one to get when I was looking at the cover. So I ended up just going with that there's also some, the ratio cover as well, like the 1:25, whatever. But I ended up just getting the Alex Garner because it was between that and the John Stewart Art Germ one. But I just liked the one that was Superboy Prime. That's basically what made the choice for me. Although I almost pulled the trigger on the Darkseid one, but then I was like, Darkseid, am I going to do John Stewart? So ultimately I left both of those and I'm just going to go with the Superboy Prime. So as far as the issue itself, it's pretty straightforward. Superboy Prime does play a big role in the issue, and it's almost like Snyder's trying to redeem him in a way. Snyder gave some interviews recently, and he had the virtual panel for New York Comic Con where he talked about this as well. And it's like, you know, right from the start of death metal, what we've been hearing is everything counts. And if you know anything about Superboy Prime, his whole thing in Infinite Crisis was him wanting to turn the clock back. Let's go back to a simpler time when the DC universe wasn't dark and gritty and heroes were heroes and villains were villains and everything was black and white. And he's trying to turn the clock back. He's trying to push the DC universe back. Whereas the DC metal or death metal event has all been all about, hey, everything counts. So with him showing up here and Wonder Woman trying to appeal to him and say, hey, we could really use your help. You need to understand what's going on. We've got to stop the Batman Who Laughs. You need to join us because if the Batman Who Laughs or Perpetua get their way, there's not going to be any DC universe, dark, gritty, happy, or otherwise. And so that's kind of the main point of this issue. And I did find it kind of interesting. And probably another part of the reason I, other than Superboy Prime showing up and me liking that character, is that this was a relatively simple issue. And most of the time, what I have found off-putting is the best way to say it. What I found off-putting about the DC death metal story has been when Snyder and Capullo say, this is cool. This is a cool idea. Let's throw that in. This is a cool idea. Let's throw that in. You know, Batman / dinosaur. Let's throw that in. Batman / castle. Let's throw that in. Batman / Batmobile. Let's throw that in. It's too much. It's too many crazy ideas. It's like, let's throw everything and the kitchen sink in there. And the pacing is off and it makes for choppy storytelling. And it hasn't had much of a flow narratively. So this issue, all we're focusing on is Batman, Wonder Woman, and Superman having gone into the dark multiverse to try to harvest crisis energy from the three big crises that have happened in the DC universe: Crisis on Infinite Earths, Infinite Crisis, and Final Crisis. And there's not a lot of other stuff going on. We're not flashing back to, okay, what's the Green Lantern Corps up to? What's, you know, going on over here with Lex Luthor and the death metal version of the Justice League? And, you know, there's a little bit about Harley and Swamp Thing, but other than that, we're just focusing on the Trinity and their mission. And so I did kind of enjoy that, because it feels like the story is kind of calming down a little bit and it's becoming a little more focused. So I feel like death metal is one of those events where I may be a fan of it because of what it does, what its effect is on the DC universe going forward, as opposed to looking at the event itself and looking at the comics themselves and saying, yes, these are technically well put together comics. You know, it's more like the big ideas, the themes of the story are what's important. And I can kind of overlook some shortcomings in the actual execution. And I know some people flip that completely. They're more interested in seeing technically good comics and, you know, being entertained and having the story, you know, make sense and be done very well. And I'm more like, if this is going to establish what the DC universe is going forward, now that 5G has kind of been thrown out or completely changed or what, however you want to put it, it's like this death metal event is laying the foundation for the DC universe going forward. And I like, from what I've seen so far, I like the direction that it's heading. Whether the execution of that is done well matters more to me than whether the execution of this actual event is done really well. Because the foundation of the DC universe going forward to me is more important technically than the technical aspects of this story. But I did enjoy the issue. It was probably one of the better ones for me so far. But again, I know I'm biased because it had had Superboy Prime in it. As far as art goes, I mean, it's Capullo art, so it looks great. I do enjoy the way Capullo draws Superboy Prime. He's not my favorite Superboy Prime artist, but I thought he did a really good job. He does draw him where he looks a little older than most people. I think a lot of people draw Superboy Prime as, you know, probably like a 17-year-old. When you think about him like that, it's like, that's John Kent, right? But Capullo, I mean, he's his own. He draws Superboy Prime as his own distinct character, looking a little older. And I did really like that as well. So I know you didn't really care for the issue, Manny. What are your thoughts?
No, I thought it was a real straightforward issue. And it really got me thinking that the entire Dark Knight's death metal story is actually pretty straightforward. If you kind of take away all of those little extra pieces that you're talking about, and I think that kind of focusing a little bit more on Superboy Prime, on Wonder Woman, kind of helped me kind of say, all right, I kind of see the direction now they're going with this, which also made me think of like the Trinity: Crisis number one, Speed Metal, Multiverses, and how they're a little bit more than tie-ins. I feel like specifically Trinity Crisis and Speed Metal, you kind of get a better idea of what's going on in four if you've read those two books, just because of how they end up coming into issue four. The other thing is, I don't know if it's just a narrative thing that they're doing or what, but I'm not really feeling the whole Sergeant Rock thing. I feel like that can be left out a little bit. But I don't know, maybe it's just because now that I've read a little bit more of it, the whole entire story is becoming a little bit clearer. But I feel like, kind of like you were saying, they've jam-packed it so much that you almost missed a point. But with this issue, I think they did a better job at staying focused. And so it was easier to enjoy overall. The only thing I really hate, dude, I just hate the Darkseid design with the horns. I hate it so much. Leave his face alone. But
this, I mean, it's different. It doesn't. I'll give you this. It's an interesting design. It doesn't look like Darkseid.
Yeah.
If you showed me that, and I didn't, and you didn't tell me it was the Dark Multiverse version of Darkseid, I wouldn't immediately, that he's not who would immediately come to mind. Like, oh yeah, that's, you know, that is, that's Darkseid.
Yeah. So yeah, I honestly, this is probably, it might be my favorite issue so far, just because I was able to enjoy a little bit more than the other ones.
Yeah. And it's been interesting too, because, you know, Snyder has said right from the beginning that this is a Wonder Woman story. It hasn't really, I mean, I know that she's been, obviously she's one of the main characters and she's probably gotten more screen time than anybody else on, you know, more real estate on the page, but it hasn't felt like a Wonder Woman, even though she's been the one that we've seen the most and she has the most agency, it hasn't felt like it's her story. And then
right. This
one with her, in this issue with her interactions with Superboy Prime, it still doesn't feel like it's a Wonder Woman story per se, but it feels like maybe we could get there by the end. Because, you know, obviously she was pretty important in the first issue, and then with the Chainsaw of Truth and killing the Batman Who Laughs, which was awesome. And certainly she's had more time on the page than Batman or Superman. So you wouldn't say it was a Batman or Superman story. It feels like an ensemble story, really. It doesn't feel like it's, you know, it's anybody is the star. It's kind of like reading a team book, you know, a Justice League book, where nobody is, you know, you wouldn't say, oh, this is a Batman story, this is a Superman story, this is a Wonder Woman story. This is like a Justice League story or a team story that happens to be a little slightly more focused on Wonder Woman than anybody else. So I guess we'll see. I mean, maybe she's the one that's going to save the day at the end of the story, and then it'll feel more like a Wonder Woman story. So, all right, well, let's move on. What do you have up for your next book?
So speaking of Wonder Woman stories, I'm going to go ahead and start this off with Wonder Woman 764. Man, I don't want to, I always want to talk good about comic books. Just specifically because I understand that, you know, the thought process that goes through them and the creative process that they go through. But Jesus Christ, the Amazon Adventures of Darren Hondor, or Miami or Bust. So this is by Mariko Tamaki with art by Steve Puh, colors by Romulo Fajardo Jr. I apologize for butchering the name. And pretty much the premise of the story is Maxwell Lord and Wonder Woman are in Miami looking for somebody. Somebody that may have some of Maxwell Lord's tech. And they're there to retrieve it. And that's all I need to tell you about it. I find it cheesy at times. I find it... it doesn't, there's nothing for me to latch onto. There's nothing for me to look forward to or really, really get excited about as far as Wonder Woman. I feel like if I'm an average fan, this is the first Wonder Woman title that I pick up. I'm not picking up Wonder Woman ever again. unless there's another creative team. It's really bland. I don't really feel too much creativity. I don't feel any passion in the story. It's just there, and I expect more. In 2020, I expect a whole lot more from a Wonder Woman book.
Yeah. So here's the thing about Wonder Woman, and you know, when the first issue of Tamaki's run came out with Mikhail Yanin on art, I was blown away. And I was telling everybody, I was banging on the drum, I was telling everybody, jump on Wonder Woman. This is the perfect time to get onto Wonder Woman. This is going to be a brand new era, and it's going to go down as classic. Like, that's how good their first issue was. It was so, so good. And then, you know, the second issue wasn't quite as good, but it's still really solid. And then the next issue, Mikhail Yanin was off the book. And I was super disappointed. And I'm not saying that Carlo Barberi's art is terrible, a little inconsistent. We had a couple issues of him on art, and I just felt like, I mean, I can't put it all on the artist because Tamaki is still writing it. But Manny and I, when we talked about the end of that first arc, we talked about how the first arc ended with a real whimper instead of a bang. And now here we are with the beginning of the next arc, and Stephen Pugh is on art, and he's an okay artist. You know, he's not great, but all of a sudden if I read the first issue of the Tamaki run and then I read this issue, and I don't know who's written either one, like you just hand them to me, no credits, I would not think that they were written by the same person. The first one was done so well, and it was great dialogue. And like Manny said, this one, the dialogue is cheesy. The story just, like, I don't know what happened. Like what? It's just been wildly inconsistent. So I'm not off Wonder Woman yet. I'm still going to give it a little more time in hopes that it can gain some consistency and be better. Because I do find it interesting, the dynamic of Wonder Woman working with her, basically her nemesis these days. Maxwell Lord is kind of more her nemesis than Cheetah at this point. But Wonder Woman deserves to be, you know, she's one of the Trinity at DC, and she deserves really high quality creators creating really good stories. And it seemed like we were going to get that. And that's what makes this so disappointing. And I think that's what's so frustrating, is that first issue, first couple issues really were so good. That's what makes it frustrating to see this book fall so far, so fast. It's like, what happened? So yeah, it's super, super frustrating. Are you going to read the next one, Manny? Or are you just done?
I'm on board. I mean, once I start something like this, I kind of want to see where it goes. Maybe it gets better. I don't know. So, you know, I'm on issue 4 of Death Metal, and I'm finally, you know, coming around to, this might be okay. Not great, but I think I really feel, and there's no disrespect to Tamaki. I think this needs a new creative team.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, there was so much promise those first couple issues,
I really wanted it to be good too, just because of the fact that Maxwell Lord is going to be featured in a film. So it's a great opportunity for people to get to know who he is, and you know, that kind of almost Lex Luthor Superman type relationship that Wonder Woman and Lord have. But they're working together. It's like a buddy cop thing. It's so weird.
Yeah, but there's a lot of hints that they're not in that Lord.
I mean, we know better, but I mean, this is just,
I don't know. Weird. I mean, it's been one incredible issue to start, and it's been
a
terrible issue to start the second. And the stuff in the middle has been in the middle. So I'm not going to completely write her off yet, but I think, and I don't know how much input Mikhail Yanin had in plot, you know, so I just bring him back on and see if it can improve. And if it doesn't, then yeah, like maybe it's time for somebody else, but I don't know. We'll see. DC just has the toughest time getting a good creator to hang on, you know, to stick with Wonder Woman for a long time. So it's kind of frustrating.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let me move on to my first book. It's called We Live from Aftershock. It's written, by the Miranda brothers, Anaka Miranda and Roy Miranda. Anaka Miranda also handles the art. We've got Ava De La Cruz on colors, Dave Sharp on letters. And basically the story is, it's far in Earth's future, and the Earth has been through some stuff. It's 2064, like climate change and different wars and different things have happened. Like there's literal monsters and humankind has faced extinction a couple times over the past few decades. And now they receive a message from space that's basically says, okay, we know humanity is going to cease to exist. It's facing its own extinction, and it's going to happen at this particular time. Like, they're giving them the date. But they also send these so-called beacons, 9 different beacons around the world, where a number of humanity can be saved. They send these, I think they're called bracelets, and they say, put these bracelets on 5,000 children, 5,000 human kids, and take them to one of the beacons and get them there before the countdown reaches zero. And so this is the story about a girl, an older girl, who's taking her younger brother, who has one of the bracelets, and trying to get him to a beacon before it reaches zero. So the art is a little bit manga influenced, a little cartoonish. The color palette is pretty bright, but it's obviously kind of a dystopian or a darker story. There's a lot of pretty adult themes in it. So I certainly wouldn't say this is a book for kids, although the artwork does make it seem that way. But it's pretty interesting. I mean, the cynic in me right away goes, well, how do you know that the message being sent from space is true? Maybe they're just trying to kidnap 5,000 kids. Maybe to them, they're ordering lunch. These aliens are going to eat these kids. I mean, who knows? So there's part of me that thinks it's all going to get flipped on its head before the end of it. But it may not be that complicated. It may just be a simple adventure story. Here's this group of people that are trying to travel from point A to point B to get these kids delivered to the place they need to go, where they'll be saved. And along the way, they're gonna have to traverse through the Badlands, where these monsters that have evolved on Earth live, and they're gonna have to fight for their survival. And it's about human struggle for survival and overcoming adversity, to save the children, that kind of thing. So I thought it was an interesting enough start. I don't know if there's more to the story, like I was saying, about things not being what they seem, or if it's going to be just more straightforward adventure and be kind of a simpler story. But I thought it was a pretty good start, and I wanted to mention it's from Aftershock, and they tend to put out pretty good book. So I thought it was pretty interesting. Pick it up when you're at your store, flip through it, see if it looks interesting enough to you. I think the artwork is done really, really well. The monsters are scary, and most of them have multiple eyes and look really great. The color work's awesome. So curious to see. I'm definitely in on this one. First issue was pretty spectacular. So what do you have up next, Manny?
So I'm pushing this ahead just because I'm getting impatient, and I want to talk about Detective 1028, not because of the issue, but because of that freaking amazing Lee Bermejo variant cover that may well be my pick for like cover of the year. I mean, I want that in my room or in my office. That Batman pose, that superhero pose that Deadpool always talks about, that superhero landing, that's what we got here. But it his facial expression, just the bat suit, the way it's kind of patched up, and the colors, and dude, it is so good. I love it so much. I know you're all about the Lee Bermejo covers all the time. So it wouldn't surprise me that you like it too. But for me, they're good. But this one, it's one of the best Batman covers I've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, I always order Lee's covers, even if, like, right now I'm buying Star Wars Bounty Hunters, the series, even though I have no intention of reading it because Lee's doing the cover. So yeah, it's all the Batman covers I feel like he's done have been really great. This one doesn't stand out to me as much as it does to you, but it's definitely a solid Bermejo cover. What I do find interesting about it is the regular covers by Kenneth Rocafort, and that's a pretty solid cover too. But this whole issue is interesting. I'm glad you decided to talk about it.
I find it to be more of a like a one shot type story, and it almost seems like a Halloween special, like a take on a Sleepy Hollow, in a way. They call it New Blood, by Peter Tomasi, with art by Nicola Scott. So obviously the art's good, and then colors by Trish Mulvihill. I can't see that very well. Why can't I see? Okay, why can't I see that well? Anyway, so the whole premise of the story is people are getting heads cut off. A cop, a judge, and a prosecutor, and they're being targeted by a ghostly officer that's mounted on a horse. Of course, Batman doesn't believe in any type of superstition, so he knows that there must be somebody behind this, a la Sherlock Holmes. And so he is on the case. Obviously, this is all spanning post-Joker War, so there's not a lot of love for Batman right now. It's interesting because I do understand that now we're going to see a lot of that, a lot of kind of anti-Batman in Gotham, and I know they've talked about that. So it was all right. For me, it was more about how they set up Gotham and what it's going to be like for Batman going forward, and some of the new players that are going to be coming in to the city overall. But for what they're trying to do ahead, I thought it was a good story for October, and then going forward to kind of setting up what we're going to see ahead.
Yeah, I agree with you. It did feel a little one and done, but I did like that they threw in some context with, like you said, people not being happy about Batman. And then the other thing that really surprised me was the art. And I know that Nicola hates drawing horses, so the fact that she gets to draw Batman, she's doing an issue of Detective, but it just so happens to have a horse in it. I got a real big kick out of that. So yeah, it was a fun issue for sure. All right, my next book that I'm going to talk about is Flash 763. It's written by Kevin Shinnick. The art is by Clayton Henry. Colors are by Marcelo Maiello, and letters are by Steve Wands. So I've been wondering, okay, who's going to be the writer of Flash now that Joshua Williamson is done with his run? And I didn't know if we were going to necessarily find out, because I know that Flash and Aquaman coming up, are their series are kind of going to be taken over by the Eternal Winter event. And so I didn't necessarily know. And I still don't know necessarily that this Kevin Shinnick guy is going to be the writer on Flash. So that remains to be seen. He's done some comic work before. Most of his creative work has been in television. He's done a lot of stuff for the Robot Chicken TV show and such. So I don't know. I mean, he hasn't done a ton of comic work, so maybe he could improve it. Kind of like Detective, this feels like a little bit of a one and done. It obviously, there's a little bit of context in terms of Barry does kind of reference where he is in terms of, you know, how he feels about all the stuff he's had to go through lately. But you take out those few references and this really could go anywhere. So it makes me wonder what DC is doing right now. Like, are we going to get a couple of issues that are almost like filler for some of these titles that aren't tying into Death Metal? Obviously, the Batman books were tied into Joker War, and then Flash had been coming to an end, the end of Joshua Williamson's run, and all these books were supposed to be, by this time, October, probably not even coming out right now because everything was supposed to be 5G. So you wonder, I mean, we know that the Brian Michael Bendis, for example, is staying on the Superman books at the end of the year when he was supposed to be off of them. And he said, well, that worked out for me because it gives me more room to finish telling the story I was going to tell instead of having to wrap it up quickly, which we know he's not that good at. But for these other books, you just wonder, are we just going to get a couple months of, or at least a month or two of these issues that feel like filler stuff, because we know, like I said, the Eternal Winter stuff is going to be in December. It's going to be in all the Justice League books. It's going to take over Flash. It's going to take over Aquaman. So is this what we have in store here? Well, let's give a chance to somebody like a Kevin Shinnick to write a couple issues of Flash and see what they can do. So I don't know if that's going to be what they do. If so, I guess it's okay. You don't really want to start anything, start a new story arc, if then the books are going to be on Eternal Winter. And then we know there's the Future State stuff coming in January, February. So there's not going to be any books then. You wouldn't pick up, if you started a story arc, you wouldn't pick it up until March of next year. That's a lot to ask people to kind of hang on. So I guess that's probably the reason we're going to get a few of these one and done type stories. So as far as this story, it's okay. You know, kind of like the detective story we were just talking about. It's self-contained. There are a few threads that Shinnick puts in here that I guess he could pick up the next issue, or even if he's going to be the regular Flash writer down the line, that he could pick up at some point as well. The art by Clayton Henry. One thing I found interesting, like normally I like Clayton Henry's art. He's been working on Superman, Batman most recently. But I just felt like in this particular issue, the line work was really heavy. And I'm used to seeing a little bit finer line work for him. And he doesn't have an inker on it. So I just thought that was kind of strange. Like certainly when he was working on Archer and Armstrong over at Valiant, the line work was much finer. Here it's just really thick lines. And so I don't know that is the best type of line weight for the Flash. I think he works better with a lighter line weight just because it shows a little more movement as opposed to, you know, feeling really down into the page. So all in all, it's an okay issue of Flash, you know, an average issue. I don't know what's going to happen with Kevin Shinnick, if he's the writer, if this is a tryout or not. If he is, I can't see myself staying on Flash long term. And I say that, take that with a grain of salt, because, you know, I'm judging it on one issue of this guy's work that I've read. But I don't know, it doesn't feel consequential enough to me that I would want to stay on the Flash. And although I am a fan of Clayton Henry, his art style isn't the best suited for the Flash either. So if it's this creative team on Flash moving forward, I probably would drop it. But that's not to say it's terrible. And it certainly is a much lighter feel in tone than what it's been with Williamson for the last little while. So if that's something that you like in your Flash comics, and you may want to jump back on if you dropped it because you felt that it was kind of boring or slow, you know, some of the complaints that we've heard about Williamson's run. And certainly with this sort of one and done type stories, things are happening much quicker, you know, like everything gets resolved in this issue, and it ends up being pretty interesting and pretty true to the character of Barry Allen. So I'll give Shinnick credit for that. All right. What do you have up next, Manny?
Up next, I have Strange Adventures number 6, written by Tom King with artwork by Mitch Gerrards and Evan Doc Shatner. So we've kind of gotten to the middle point of the story, as to say, and I know that you and I have talked about a couple of other Tom King runs, and this is kind of where sometimes it kind of gets a little, there's a little bit of a lull, but the Strange Adventures 6 still continues with kind of the present and the past of everything that is going on back when, where they're from. And the present is this kind of conversation between Alana Strange and Mr. Terrific, which I think is they have really good interactions. It's almost like I almost feel like it's a chess match. And I do give it up to Tom King for Alana being able to kind of have this conversation with Mr. Terrific, who is obviously so smart and intelligent. And I don't know how much it just elevated her for me. And I thought that was really cool. The way that their interaction throughout the book. And then just we kind of see things start to escalate also on Ran. Is it Ran or Ron? It's Ran, right?
I've heard it pronounced both ways, but I think Ran is correct.
Okay. Ran. and so I think now with issue 7, we're going to really start seeing kind of the nitty gritty of what's going on and what Mr. Terrific is going to be finding out more than he already has. So I almost feel like this is kind of like the calm before the storm issue. And I look forward to see what we have going forward with 7. I hope it doesn't turn out to be one of those like Heroes in Crisis where it just kind of stays at a lull. I think that this one's going to build up a little bit better and give us a better climax to the story.
Yeah, I'm still behind. I think I'm going to catch up, and I just haven't, man. I've read issue 1, and that's it. So I definitely need to get on it. That's totally on me. All right, well, let me talk about the next book on my list. I'm going to talk about Commanders in Crisis. This is from Image, co-created by Steve Orlando, the writer, and David Tinto, the artist. We also have on the creative team Francesca Cortenuto. I hope I'm saying that right. It's Cortenuto. Cortenuto, I think that's right. And Fabio Emilia on letters with Fabrizio Verocci on design. There's a ton of covers. We've got the A covered by David Tinto. Stefan Sedgwick does a cover. Peach Momoko has a cover. Micah Sozo, David Talaski, Emmanuel Lupacchino, and Mirka Andolfo. All have covers. So there is a foreword by Dan Didio, who talking about Steve Orlando and how much he loves superhero comics and giving a little bit of history and Dan's thoughts on this story. So, you know, you hear Commanders in Crisis and immediately you think, well, okay, Image book. Wait, if it's a crisis, shouldn't it be a DC book? Well, really what this book is, it's Steve Orlando's sort of love letter to the big epic events and crises that happen in superhero comics, these big crossovers with heroes from different multiverses and such. And so, you know, I don't want to give away too much, but it's a diverse cast and Steve does a great job of bringing together a team of heroes who are diverse and very representative of, you know, the world outside your window. And there's a specific reason that each one of these heroes is a member of the Commanders in Crisis. And you could even say that there's their backgrounds sort of lead into why they would be called Commanders in Crisis. They're all a member of a team that's called Crisis Command, because they've come together to try to prevent crisis. So that makes sense. But then when you talk about the actual title of the book, Commanders in Crisis, it makes sense once you hear what the background is of these characters. So a lot of setup for this first issue. We don't really get that information until almost at the very end of the issue where things sort of click into place. But I was happy that Steve did it that way and instead gave us some action and some mystery in the beginning, because he kind of sets the hook. And then toward the end of the issue, when you find out more about the background of the different team members, it sort of brings everything into focus and really makes you want to read the next issue. So I really enjoyed it. I think it's going to be a fun book where Steve's going to explore some things like diversity and like inclusion and things like that, but he's doing it through his love of superhero comics and through a really fun, big, bombastic story. So it's going to feel like that sort of message isn't like, you know, shoved down your throat. It just so happens that this is a great superhero story that's really fun and over the top with a lot of action and great visuals. And it just so happens that, you know, a lot of the characters involved in it happen to be, you know, a diverse cast that kind of is representative of, you know, the world we live in. That hasn't been the case in a lot of big events in the past. When you talk about, you know, classic heroes, they were mostly white, they were mostly male. And it wasn't really representative of, you know, what society and civilization worldwide look like. So it's great that Steve's going to be, you know, telling a story as big as any of those, but with a cast that's a little more representative of what, you know, the human race looks like. So I really enjoyed the first issue. When I first heard about this and Steve was pulling out all the stops, my expectations, I tried to keep them tempered because he, you know, we were hearing this thing's going to be out there and it's going to be, you know, the biggest thing ever that Steve's done. And, you know, there was a lot of hype, and I try to keep my expectations low because, you know, it's hard to live up to, you know, expectations that are too high. But this blew me away. I mean, I really thought it was great. And I'm not familiar with the artist or co-creator, David Tinto, at all. Like, I hadn't even heard the name before I heard that he was working with Steve on this book. But I think the art is done really, really well. It's colored with a very bright palette, so it does have that classic, you know, superhero feel. And thought the line work is really good. The way it's paced is done well, both narratively and visually. David's transitions from panel to panel, the technology that he's putting in here, the backgrounds, you know, a lot of great concepts from both him and Steve in terms of the way the multiverse functions and, you know, the different technologies and weapons that these characters have. So yeah, really, really fun comic. And so for me, it's a must read. You got to pick it up and check it out. It's absolutely fantastic issue. Like, really, if you're a fan of superhero comics, you will like this. Definitely pick it up. All right. What do you have up next, Manny?
I don't know why I always have this. This I gravitate towards strange books, and then it's like, yeah, this looks interesting, and I find out it's 100 pages or 80 pages or 75 pages. It's like this thing goes on forever. Last time it was the Swamp Thing book, which was great. Not complaining about it. And this week, it's DC's The Doomed and the Damned, the 80 page. Giant, just in time for Halloween. So this book has a whopping 10 stories in it, and but I will say that what I really like about it is that you get to see these team ups that you don't really get to see ever sometimes. For example, you get a Beast Boy and Clarion story, which I thought was done really well by Travis Moore, who did also, I thought the artwork on that was really, really good. Another one I will point out, there was one with Wonder Woman and Raven called Inner Demons by Amanda Dibert, which was fantastic. And it kind of comes to, it was just a really good mix of empathy and also knowing that you've got to take care of your inner demons and how to do that. And then one that really stuck out to me, and it even made me feel sorry for Solomon Grundy. There's one called 7 Days with Solomon Grundy and Ra's al Ghul by Marv Wolfman, and with art by Tom Mandrake. Just man, like the way that Ra's al Ghul just handles Solomon Grundy for his own personal greed was just ridiculous. So what's funny about it is that this entire book has team ups except for Batman. Batman doesn't team up with anyone. He has a solo story by Saladin Ahmed, And I was like, that's kind of cheating. I mean, you even have like a weird story with Orphan and Orca, who you never see. But probably the funniest story in this book. I don't know if you got a chance to read it, but if you haven't, just go to the last story by Garth Ennis. I think that just by saying it's by Garth Ennis should be enough. With artwork by PJ Holden, it features the characters Beator and Darkseid, and the story is called Beator versus Darkseid, where for whatever reason, Darkseid is at a bar to have a drink, and it belongs, and the bar is ran by Beator, who by the way, I have no idea who he is. It's some weird alien looking creature thing. and he is conned and pressured and whatever you want to call it into having a drinking contest with Beator. And it is just so funny because it makes fun of things like cancel culture and just the power of social media, and it's something that you would never think Darkseid would be wrapped up in, but it's a good time. It's funny. And so I highly recommend to at least read that because it's just funny. The other stories, Aquaman and Frankenstein and Follow the Water by Brandon Thomas and Baldmar Rivas, and Superman and Swamp Thing in From Humble Roots by Ahmed Torturo with art by Max Fiumara. And then your introductory story is Madame Xandu and Manbat in Grief's Quiet Name by John R. Cudi and art by Mike Perkins. So a lot of stuff going on in this book, but as far as ratings go, the Wonder Woman and Raven story, Inner Demons, probably my favorite one there, followed by Beator versus Darkseid. I left one out. There's a Green Lantern team up with Etrigan in The Shadow Over Coast City by Kenny Porter with art by Riley Rossmo. None of these stories really take very long. Obviously, there's 10 of them in an 80-page book, but they're pretty fun, especially that last one. It mixes a lot of stuff that people talk about now with Darkseid. You just don't expect it, and for being a one-shot book, has a lot of characters that you sometimes don't get to see as often, and I think they did a good job.
Yeah, I read all of them except the Green Lantern one. I couldn't do it with the Rossmo art. I've had so much Rossmo art lately, and I couldn't do it, man. Like after, because didn't he have a story in the Swamp Thing?
I think so. Yeah.
He's had stories recently in some of the DC death metal anthologies also. And I just don't like his art. I couldn't do it. Like, as soon as I turned the page and I saw he was on Green Lantern, I'm like, I'm skipping that one, man. I can't do it. But yeah, I thought the Wonder Woman one with Raven was probably my favorite. But yeah, the Darkseid one was pretty funny. Also, the Batman one by Ahmed, it didn't feel incomplete, but it felt a little rushed. Like, I feel like Saladin probably needed a whole issue on his own to tell that story. He could have fleshed it out because it just felt a little incomplete, I guess. Felt like there was more he wanted to say. But overall, yeah, pretty good anthology. I like DC does these anthologies and gives people a shot that you don't see working on these characters. So, all right, up to my last book. It's Rorschach from DC's Black Label, written by Tom King. We have art by Jorge Fornes, colors by Dave Stewart, letters by Clayton Cowles. I know that there's a lot of people that hate on DC for continuing to use Watchmen characters. I'm keeping Watchmen in print because I feel like they're stealing from Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons. We could dedicate a whole podcast to that, just talking about the different complexities. I can see both sides of it. I mean, the fact of the matter is that DC has kept Watchmen in print, you know, ever since it came out. And so the rights have never had the opportunity to revert back to Gibbons and Alan Moore. And, but it's not like it ever hasn't sold. So, you know, from that perspective, you can't blame DC for keeping it in print because it always sells. Should DC have changed the terms of the contract and given more rights to it to Moore and Gibbons? I mean, that's a whole nother thing. It's their corporate entity. They're not bound by morality. So it's yeah, like I said, I can see both sides. But that being said, I always felt like Watchmen should have been kept separate. Not a big fan of the fact that with Rebirth and Doomsday Clock, Geoff Johns decided to mix those. You know, it was one thing when DC came out and did the Before Watchmen miniseries, but it was still self-contained. And then for whatever reason, they decided, hey, we're going to bring Dr. Manhattan and these characters into the main DCU. We can argue about how well that worked or didn't work. It wasn't a debacle, I'll say that, but I don't know that it really worked. And, you know, again, there's a lot that goes into that. John's, you know, not staying on as chief creative officer at DC, and Doomsday Clock taking so long to come out, and other editorial changes, and if things have been kept tighter and more controlled, would Rebirth, the success of Rebirth, have lasted longer? And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of complexity to it. So you can argue all that kind of stuff and talk about whether it was successful to integrate the Watchmen characters into the DC universe or not. But what you can't argue with, in my mind, is the quality of this issue and the quality of this story. So Tom King wrote this as he would write a screenplay or a movie. So he basically wrote it all as one big story and then divided it up into the issues. So the whole thing is written. We know it's going to come out on time. There's not going to be any kind of delays like we had with Doomsday Clock. It's called Rorschach, but is it the Rorschach we know from the original Watchmen? Is it the Rorschach we know from Doomsday Clock? Is it somebody else? That's part of the mystery. And Tom King is writing this, but it really feels like he's writing it as a novel or as a screenplay where it's one big thing. And it's a mystery. It's a mystery story. And, you know, you might think, well, is it a superhero story? Is it an action story? What kind of mixture is it going to be? But right away, when you start reading it, it's so clear that this is a mystery. And, you know, there's some elements of crime noir, but it doesn't feel super dark or, you know, super gritty the way, or depressing the way a lot of people, you know, when they talk about Tom King's work, it's a super, and Tom King even makes fun of it, right? Like a Tom King story starts off and it's a Superman or Green Lantern or Flash or whoever is sitting there all alone in the dark, staring out the window through the rain, right? Like super depressing, super lonely, super just a downer of a story. This isn't that. It's much fresher than that. It's much more nuanced than that. And that's not to say that it's, you know, super bright and bubbly superhero type comic, because that's not Tom King. And it's certainly not what you would expect from a mystery story. But there's a lot of other nuance. There's a lot of other themes going on. There's other comic websites that have been talking about theories on it. Like, is King going to go meta and bring in actual real comic book creators and kind of turn the whole story on its head? He might not. It might be just more implied, but we're certainly getting some hints here that it is a little meta. Some of the people involved in the story so far are comic creators themselves, not necessarily people that we know, not real life people, but the seeds are there. So I just thought it was a great first issue that sets up a mystery, and it sets the hook early, and you really want to know, okay, what's going on? What happened? Who are the players involved? Who is Rorschach? Who was under the mask? And there's a little bit of a political background as well to it. So you wonder how much King might pull out the whole divisiveness of political parties from different sides of the aisle and how that might affect an investigation into something that happens where people want the truth to come out or don't want the truth to come out based on how it might affect their, you know, political party or their political affiliations. And, you know, what is the truth, which is, you know, something he's exploring more in Strange Adventures, but some of that may bleed in here as well. So I thought it was absolutely fantastic. And like, as soon as I read it, I was just blown away. I was like, man, to me, this is the best thing that Tom's written in quite a while. I would say I probably enjoyed the first issue of Rorschach even more than I enjoyed the first issue of Mr. Miracle. So that's, you know, that's really saying something. So yeah, I thought it was fantastic. It's definitely my book of the week. I think you have to pick this up for sure. It's a must read. I almost gave it to Commanders in Crisis. It was kind of a toss up, but ultimately I went with this just because I think it's something really, really special. So I know you read it too, Manny. What were your thoughts on it?
It's just a different way to do it. I like the perspective of starting off with trying to figure out who the character was, but I'm kind of on that bandwagon of like, leave these characters alone a little bit. I mean, there's so many other great DC characters that you can explore. Why you had to revive these for now, which I get it. I mean, they sell, so you might as well do it. And I mean, I'm picking it up tomorrow when I go get my books. So it says something because obviously if you really don't support something, the only way to do it is not to complain on the internet. It's just not to pick up the book. So I mean, that says something. But yeah, it was, I thought it was done really well. And, but I don't know, I'm going to give it another issue. I'm not that interested, but it, nothing against it.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to talk about because, you know, people say, well, leave these characters alone. And I know it's a Rorschach, but it doesn't seem like it's a Rorschach that we've ever seen before.
Right.
So it's like, but I guess he's using the identity of Rorschach, which is one that people are familiar with. So
I do like the fact that he didn't do the whole Rorschach narrating thing where I think that's what's kept me interested a little bit, is the fact that I was expecting that kind of, like, he's talking about the conspiracies and giving all these, like, not puns, but, you know, comparisons and whatever. And this time, you know, it's kind of backwards and it's from a different perspective. So I do like that about it.
Yeah. And one last thing I'll say about it is the artwork by Jorge Fornes. We loved his art from the beginning. The first time we saw it, which was on Hot Lunch Special with Elliot Rahal, which is more of a crime noir. This has a little bit of crime noir elements, but it doesn't go
right
that far the way Hot Lunch Special does. So I really encourage you, if you haven't read Hot Lunch Special, it's from Aftershock, go pick up the graphic novel and read it, man. It's or the trade. It's absolutely spectacular. And Jorge, it didn't take long. You know, he was on that series, and then from there, Tom King saw his work, and he's done work on Batman, and a lot of people compare him to Lee Weeks or David Mazzucchelli. I think he's his own kind of thing. And I think his artwork, I don't know that it necessarily, for me, that Jorge's work necessarily works for me that well on Batman. It works better on Batman than it would on a true superpowered superhero like Superman or something like that. But really, for me, his work, his style works best on characters that don't have any superpowers whatsoever. And you can make the argument Batman is a superhero or not. That's neither here nor there. But when you talk about why Jorge's artwork works so well on Hot and Not Special, it's because that's a story about normal people, you know, albeit criminals, but, you know, normal people. When you talk about here in the Watchmen universe, as long as Dr. Manhattan doesn't show up, you're talking about people that don't have superpowers. And so I think his artwork, when it comes to drawing these types of stories, works really well. And, you know, you throw in the added wrinkle of it being a mystery, and the things that Jorge chooses to show, the camera angles, what he shows and what he doesn't show becomes very important, because, you know, a lot of these panels probably are described in great detail by Tom King. You know, let's show them this piece of evidence. Let's show them this piece of evidence. And what we may find when we go back and after having read the whole story and understanding what the mystery is and you know, having the answers to that mystery, I promise you, we will go back and we will just look at the artwork in the first few issues, and we will see visual clues that we didn't pick up on at first because we didn't know their significance. But then once you have all the answers and you go back and look, I'm sure Tom has planted things there that Jorge has done a masterful job of illustrating, where we're going to go, oh, yep, look, that was a clue. That was a clue. That was a clue. And so again, just speaks to the overall strength of the story, I think, and what a great start it is. That's probably part of the reason that Tom decided to write it the way he did, as, you know, one big story, one big novel, if you will, because then he's not building as he goes, and it allows him to be sure he's putting those clues in early on. So I'm going to be surprised, Manny, if you don't get sucked in and at the end be like, oh my God, this is so good. I mean, I understand your apprehension and the whole desire to have the Watchmen characters be left alone, because I felt that way at first too. But I guess I've just come to realize, well, that's never going to happen. DC.
Well, it's hard to do now. I mean,
yeah,
you have the TV show, which, you know, award-winning show now with some of the with Regina King, and then you have the success of you know what they did before. So I mean, it's popular, people want it, so you got to do it. I mean, if it sells, DC would, you know, with as hard as it is sometimes to get people to buy things, I don't blame them. I don't.
Yeah, exactly. And plus the fact that, you know, now that they have done it, now that they have said, okay, well, you know, part of the reason that the DC multiverse was so screwed up was because of Dr. Manhattan. Like, you've made that canon now.
Right.
So you can't, you know, you can't, I mean, you could, because it's comics, you could retrocon that out, but it makes it a lot tougher. So. All right, well, let me give a rundown on some of the other titles that you might want to be on the lookout for today. Over at Boom, we have a Once and Future number 12 from Dan Mora and Kieran Gillen. You also have the third issue of Seven Secrets from Tom Taylor, which has been a pretty big hit. At DC, in addition to the books that we talked about, Batman and the Outsiders, written by Brian Edward Hill, comes to a close with issue number 17. I read issue number 17, the final issue, and I found it interesting. I've been buying that, and I haven't even read the first issue, so I'll probably sit down and read like all 17 in one sitting, even though I've read the final issue. I was curious enough, well, how does this end, even though I don't even know how it begins. And it was pretty interesting. Puts Batman, it ends by putting Batman in a place that he's not used to being. So I'm looking forward to checking that out. Green Lantern season 2 from Grant Morrison and Liam Sharp has issue 8 on stands today. Hawkman 28, which is the penultimate, the next to last issue of that series by Robert Venditti, is on stands today. We also have Superman number 26 from Brian Michael Bendis and Ivan Harris. Over at Image, it was a pretty light week other than Commanders in Crisis number 1 that I talked about. We have Firepower by Robert Kirkman and Chris Somney. The third issue of that has, and the first issue, both have a second printing out on stands today. And then I also wanted to mention a second printing of Stillwater number 1 by Chip Zdarsky, if you missed that one the first time around. Over at Marvel, we have Amazing Spider-Man number 50, which, you know, another oversized issue, $6 after 49 last week was $10 or 2 weeks ago, because 49 was actually legacy number 850 and then regular series number. So it's like, man, Marvel, have your cake and eat it too with these legacy numbers. It really doesn't sit well with me. But anyway, that is on stands today. Captain Marvel number 22 is also out. Latest issue of Immortal Hulk from Al Ewing, number 38, is on stands today. And we've got from the X-Men corner of the Marvel Universe, X of Swords or Ten of Swords Handbook, number 1. And then the last thing that I'll mention is from Valiant, we have Bloodshot number 9, written by Tim Seeley. So those are some of the books on stands today that you may want to be on the lookout for when you hit your local comic shop. Anything else you want to add, Manny?
Nope, I think you covered it all.
All right. Well, we want to thank everybody for listening as always. Be sure to go out and support your local comic shop. Set up a pull list, pre-order your books. That's always the best thing you can do to support them. And as we're closing out here, last thing I'll mention, a little bit of comic book news in the original art corner of comics that I found out today. So Gil Kane had kept the original artwork to Amazing Spider-Man number 129, which is the first appearance of the Punisher, and actually sold it unbeknownst to anybody, quietly and privately to a personal collector. And that guy sat on it for years and years and years and years. Well, he's finally decided to put it up for auction on Comic Connect. So the very first appearance of the Punisher, Amazing Spider-Man 129, the cover, which is, you know, first time anybody ever saw the character in terms of, you know, comic buying audience, is going up for auction. And they're estimating that it's going to go for about $2 million. So I can only imagine how much that guy paid for it. It wasn't anywhere near $2 million. Maybe it's time he's decided to retire. I'm not sure. And in case you're wondering where that estimate comes from, probably the closest artwork that you could compare it to in terms of importance is the artwork for The Incredible Hulk number 181, which was the first appearance of Wolverine. So it's probably a little more important than the Punisher at this point, but that was also a few years ago. So prices, you know, inflation and whatever. So I wouldn't be surprised if Amazing Spider-Man number 129, if the artwork goes for even more. I mean, it's a Spider-Man cover. It's the first Punisher. People are gonna go crazy. So yeah,
I'll
keep you updated when it sells and let you know what the final price is. But I saw that today. I thought I would mention it. It's pretty interesting. I immediately got on Twitter and I was like, all right, Dinesh, how are you willing to go?
So, I have that cover signed by Jerry Conway.
A print of it or?
No, the book.
Like a reprint?
A second print, yeah.
I was going to say, what? Because
no, I know.
First print, like graded, goes for a lot, thousands and thousands of dollars. So, you know, I've been working on my Amazing Spider-Man run during this pandemic, and I'm getting pretty close. I need, when you talk about going from issue 200 up to 850, I guess it just came out, I'm only missing like maybe 20 books. And then from 100 to 200, I have about 20, 25 books. And then below 100, I have like maybe 10 or 15. So eventually I'll go in and fill in 1 through 199, mostly. You know, like probably 1 through 10 I'll never own unless they're really beat to hell. But I might fill them in with those reprints. But 129 is one that I doubt I'll ever be able to afford a legitimate one. I'm probably going to have to go one of those reprints. So, cause it's just, I mean, even in like 1.0 shape, it's still like a couple thousand dollars. And I just can't justify spending that one. Unless I win the lottery or something, which I don't play. So it makes it really hard to win. So anyway, like I said, we'll keep you all updated, when that sells, cause I'm really curious to hear what it'll go for. So, anyway, once again, we want to thank everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.